You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
In the studio with me is Mark Smalley, the co-founder and chief technology officer at NeuroWare, or CTO at NeuroWare Incorporated. Mark has founded a digital design agency, and he's based in Kuala Lumpur. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back to BFM.
As a graduate of the very grueling 500 Startups Accelerator, are you excited with how things are moving at NeuroWare currently?
It's a slow process, for sure. We've been doing a lot of education over the past 18 months.
In the recent SC by SC conference that we saw a few weeks back, there were six equity crowdfunding platforms that was approved by Securities Commission of Malaysia. Among them is 88plus, Crowdo, Eureka, and so on. Are you involved in any of these six companies that were approved by the ECF platform, by the SC?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. We actually approached Ataplus about 6 months ago as a client. They are our first subscribed user of Cortex, our blockchain-based operating system. And since then, we've also become their client by now raising on their platform.
The NeuroWare is heavily involved with blockchain technology. And as a regular listener on the street, how would you break down blockchain for us?
Yeah, it's a massive ecosystem now. The actual overriding terminology for the entire ecosystem is distributed ledger technology. Some distributed ledger tech uses blockchains, but there are lots of different blockchains that do different things. People sometimes hear of Bitcoin, and sometimes they hear of blockchains. They're kind of the same thing, but also very different. Their stories connected. You can think of blockchains as the underlying technology. It's a new sort of data storage method. Best analogy would be looking at it as a ledger, a distributed shared ledger that anybody can use, whereas Bitcoin is the digital currency. The real breakthrough there is that transfer and settlement now occurs as a single event due to that shared ledger. But Bitcoin as a digital currency is really only the first successful application that's been built on top of blockchain technology.
When you say that NeuroWare is interested in helping companies that want to involve themselves in distributed ledger technology, what do you mean by that? What kind of advances can you bring and help for these companies if they are interested in blockchain?
A lot of people consider us as a fintech company due to the fact that fintech businesses are approaching us. And the reason for that is the fintech value is the data that they hold is valuable. We actually had a previous product. So we've been in the blockchain space, so the funded as a startup now for 2.5 years. Our original product was a developer toolkit called Blockstrap. And we was growing that at 80% month over month, but struggling to monetize at the time because developers weren't willing to spend money at that time. But what it got to us to do is last year, the end of last year, we helped DBS organize the world's first bank-backed blockchain hackathon in Singapore. It's a huge event. They spent a lot of money on that. And during that event, we really got to learn what it was that the enterprises were really looking for. Everyone that was sponsoring that event was looking to do one of two things. They were looking to store structured data on the blockchains in some way, or store identity and authorization sort of protocols on the blockchain. So from that event, we actually ditched our initial product, the Blockstrap product, commercial support for that, and went off into isolation for a year to build non-financial distributed protocols. What we did that for is rather than rushing into designing the end solution, we wanted to abstract the problem. So by developing these protocols rather than solutions, we can actually plug into any blockchain. And that's really one of our global differentiators is the fact that we work on all blockchains. We're a blockchain agnostic company because there's lots of different blockchains that do lots of different things. There's no one magic blockchain that solves every problem, just like there's no one magic database that solves every problem. You know, there's different databases for different use cases in the same sense that there's different blockchains for different use cases.
Let's talk a little bit about the Blockstrap framework, as you rightfully pointed out. Apparently, a Blockstrap aims to lower the bar of entry for cryptocurrency application. Is this an accurate depiction of this Blockstrap framework?
Yeah, it's essentially a jQuery plugin. Very easy for mid-level developers to jump straight in and start building full blockchain-based applications entirely from the browser, without any need for centrally storing the keys. And it also abstracts out where you can get the data source from. So not only does it support 10 blockchains out of the box, you can plug in new blockchains and you can get that data from various sources, whether that's from publicly available APIs or private APIs that you download or even directly from the Bitcoin nodes themselves.
Now, of course, this allows for these developers to rapidly build Bitcoin-enabled applications. Does it mean that banks would have an upper advantage now?
Yeah, well, I mean, blockchains a distributed ledger ecosystem as a whole is definitely a complicated field. I've been a technology consultant for the past 15 years now, and I've never quite met anything as exciting or intricate at the same time. There's a lot of caveats, and because the ecosystem's so large now, there's so many different sort of solutions available. The aim of Blockstrap and really NeuroWare as a whole is to abstract all of those choices so that you can just rely on a single platform that can plug into the different platforms or protocols as required, but sort of abstract the choice away to the users so it's a single interface or a single framework for managing everything.
I think fintech still dominates the conversation when we talk about blockchain. In fact, very recently, the Central Bank of Singapore, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, has allowed for interbank settlements to be done over cryptocurrency. Does this spell the end of paper money in the future, where organizations, people, they can just make payments and settle payments through cryptocurrency using blockchain?
It's complicated, but we certainly have a problem when it comes to paper money. And the future of money is most certainly going to be digital. There's no question about that. In fact, you know, 80, 90, 95% of the world's value is already digital in some sense. The question really becomes, who's going to be managing that ledger that contains everybody's values? Is it going to be a national institution? Is it going to be a private institution? Or is it going to be the public? That's the story that's not been unfolded yet.
Which party, in your opinion, would be better in terms of managing this custodianship of data or identity?
Identity. I'm a big believer that identity needs a seismic shift at the moment, that we should be owning our own identity and that applications should be plugging into us and asking for permission rather than us plugging into the applications for permission.
But it's not how things are made up right now, isn't it?
No, we have central authorities that control who we are. We're really just a collection of events, I guess, in some sense. You could say that Facebook owns our identity at the moment.
Yeah, and do you foresee us, you know, taking ownership of identity at least in the near future?
Indeed, yeah. 5 to 10 years is going to be a massive seismic shift. You can see that through the evolution of networks as a whole. We once only had one kind of network. We had centralized networks. We eventually introduced the world to decentralized networks, such as the cloud. And we now have distributed networks. The point there is that that's an evolution in not just security or technology, but it's also an evolution in business models. The current unicorns in the world are those sort of decentralized businesses. You could think of the Ubers and the Alibabas, not owning any stock or not owning any cars. And the next wave of huge businesses, I believe, is going to be distributed businesses.
You know, because on one hand, blockchain is meant to make everything secure. But on the other hand, at least in the cryptocurrency conversation, there are security breaches. So how do we cross that technology sphere and make it more secure?
So that's really a huge misconception that's portrayed by the media. The Bitcoin protocol itself has never had an actual theft or a reverse transaction or a double spend, which are the big problems we're trying to solve. If you think about it, there's actually $9 or over $10 billion worth of value now publicly available. When hackers try to hack into systems, they spend the most of their time and resources trying to find where that data is. In the case of Bitcoin, we have it openly available. Everybody knows where it is. And there's over $10 billion value there for every hacker on the planet to have tried to steal it. The reports that we hear in the media most often are not actually Bitcoin protocol thefts. They're application thefts. That means that there, you know, somewhere in the world, there's a 16-year-old who's just created his own first digital bank, and he accepts Bitcoin and so on and so forth. And it's his application, it's his website that gets hacked, not the actual Bitcoin protocol. A lot of it comes down to, as you pointed out, it's an unregulated system, and there's a lot of interest in the system. So we have a wide collection of people offering services, and can't really be sure as to the quality of their skills or experience.
Yeah, there's a few interesting quotes here, because you do say that the data output was suboptimal, and that by building your own open source software on top of your own APIs, this is not like dog food, as you say. What do you mean by this?
Okay, dog fooding. From the first day we launched our public APIs, 2.5 years ago, we were building applications on top of those APIs. So because we were actively building a whole wide range of different products and services on top of the APIs, we were able to more quickly find out where the APIs were lagging or where they needed to be improved, rather than just providing the API services only and sitting back and letting other people hopefully inform us on what was needed.
You were also saying that you're totally obsessed with modularity.
Indeed, yes.
And why is that important?
So I guess where I started in my development world would have been back on WordPress. In the WordPress world, we have this notion of
the CMS, the content management system,
themes and plugins. Yeah. And so that sort of got ingrained into my head from a young age that everything needed to be extendable in order for other people to improve it. Because at the end of the day, nobody has all the right answers, at least not me. All that I can do is provide a platform that's easy to extend or easy to improve in ways that I could never have conceived of.
You believe that the true mainstream blockchain adoption may end up relying on the removal of the cryptocurrency from the conversation. Do you still hold to this view?
There's certain boardrooms that you can go into where you're not allowed to say the word, the B word, the first B word, the Bitcoin B word.
The Bitcoin word, yeah.
Yeah. If you say that, you'll get shown out of the room straight away. Whereas if you, you know, use the word blockchain, you're allowed into the room. And there's a reason for that. Obviously, Bitcoin is a currency, and unfortunately, currencies and economy and the financial world as a whole is a very polarizing topic.
You do say that some markets, if they do adopt a true free market kind of nature, they should be allowed to decide on their own natural decisions by using technology like blockchain. But you do say that we are a long way from having that kind of true freedom. Why do you say this? What's stopping us from having this so-called true freedom?
It's the central gatekeepers at the moment. We are forced through regulatory hurdles for a reason. And I mean, speaking about regulation, you know, the Bank Negara and the Securities Commission have been doing a phenomenal job here in Malaysia compared to some of the things I've been seeing elsewhere going on. Really supportive of this new ecosystem and of this new technology.
A lot can be said about the regulatory framework in terms of inhibiting the creation of new technology. In fact, the biggest enemy for a disruptor like yourself would be regulation. And I'm saying this Bank Negara or Securities Commission, I'm just saying that, you know, regulation inhibits innovation. But having said that, we are being built from the ground up in terms of the traditional financial world, in the traditional rules and regulations. Is it because of this notion of doing things by the book, it's going to stop us from innovating even further?
It depends whose book you're talking about. So I often get asked what my views are on fintech as a whole. And for me, I actually refer to the entire ecosystem as choice. The only reason we have a fintech ecosystem is because there is now more than just a bank to deal with. Previously, we only had banks and regulated, fully licensed institutions to deal with. And so there wasn't a fintech industry. The fact that we do have a fintech industry here now in Malaysia and that the regulators are so involved and behind it, to me, it symbolizes their position. It shows that they're now saying they've had enough with the banks.
Is it fair to say that the enemy right now, at least for this revolution, are the commercial banks, and that central banks, just like MAS in Singapore, just like the Swedish Central Bank, and now the SC of Malaysia and Bank Negara, they want to see a better management of the financial industry, and therefore it's your friend? Is it a fair depiction?
I mean, that's ironic. Ironically, the holy grail for regulators and bankers is Bitcoin. Yet it's the scary word, because Bitcoin is only pseudonymous. So yeah. You can have accountability, traceability, all these things that they want. You can build that straight into the protocol.
So, you know, issues like money laundering, for instance, can easily be thwarted by, cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had this whole drama of, you know, billions of ringgit being transferred in and out, at least for this country. The whole 1FDB saga, the whole mBank saga. Do you think that with blockchain and cryptocurrency wouldn't have happened?
Yeah, exactly. With blockchain, we would have had an accountable record of such events. Had we used blockchain and Bitcoin, it wouldn't have happened.
And therefore, this is the bigger question, right? Because the big notion of political will is in play. Mm-hmm. The powers that be, they might not want to see this kind of transparency taking place at this level. Do you see your work being hindered because of this?
No, not at all. It's not a winner wins all game. That, you know, we are always going to have a shadow economy. We are always going to have a regulated economy. there's always going to be ways to transact without anybody knowing regardless. But there's not going to be one end winner. There's going to be both. So why not improve, you know, everything in the process?
So in India, they decirculated the large bills, the 500 rupee bill, the 1,000 rupee bill. And it's not because they are, the government's aim is to inconvenience the people, however likely it is the case. It is actually meant to thwart, you know, illegal money laundering cash activities, right? Mm. And do you see this taking part in reality, at least in some markets?
It was really interesting in India when that happened. 24 hours after the news broke, the price of Bitcoin in India was $150 more than anywhere else. And we see this trend happening in, because it's a free market, right? We see as countries' economies get worse or publicized as to how bad they are, we get a drive in adoption for Bitcoin. And so you have different countries paying different rates. In India and China, due to their collapsing currencies at the moment, they're paying a lot more than most. In fact, in Zimbabwe, they're paying almost double what people pay in America.
Wow. In Zimbabwe right now? Okay.
Double the price because there's not so many of them available and there's such a high supply. You know, it's all a free market is just supply and demand that no one but the people can control.
And where does the central bank fit in? Because wouldn't they?
Well, the central bank only ever arrived because of the banks first inventing money. When banks first started, opened their doors for the first days, all the banks did was take physical assets that belonged to other people and give them a piece of paper that said, we'll give you that back one day if we can. The problem is every single branch, every single brand had their own pieces of paper and things got out of control really quickly. So eventually they introduced the notion of central banking, which is only 300 years old. It's quite a new concept. And the whole notion of quantitative easing is an experiment. Japan just last week finished that experiment. They declared that it was a complete and utter disaster.
It's a failure.
They'll no longer be trying it again. But still, because we don't have things such as blockchain technology at a governmental level, we don't know if what they're saying is true. We don't know if they're never going to try print. How do we know if they don't print anymore ever again? We won't know.
There's a high level of distrust with people doing financial markets right now. In fact, this level of distrust is translated to many governments being changed in hands, let alone, you know, individuals like Donald Trump being elected into office. There's Marine Le Pen in France. There's the Brexit. Is it because of the high level of distrust with those that are perceived to be in the establishment that people are really now craving for something disruptive like blockchain?
If only the people were craving. It's unfortunately, right now, it feels like it's just still just the technologists. There's so much misunderstanding. It's hard to have faith in a new technology if you don't understand what the existing...
Can I simply fault the technologists for using words that people don't understand?
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you're a CTO. I'm pretty sure people in NeuroWare, at least, are complaining. There's this big problem when layman doesn't understand what's going on. We saw that with Edward Snowden, for instance. The level of metadata, data collection that is being done by the intelligence fraternity in the US. And the problem with Edward Snowden at that moment in time, at least, or even now for that matter, is that people don't understand the level of data capture that the government is doing. And while Edward Snowden is trying his best in trying to educate the public, he's still being vilified and adored in equal measure by people on the street. Is it because of the complexity of the information that needs to be shared, or things are simply not that easy to be broken down for the regular guy?
It's a whole combination for sure. I still think it has a lot to do with it's hard to know something new if you don't understand something old. Like if we don't already understand how the economy works, if you don't already understand where does the value of that money in your pocket come from and who's in charge of... international rate, all these things. The economy as a whole, I guess, is a very complicated matter. And if you're trying to jump into understanding a new economy without understanding how the old economy works, it's, you know, it's impossible.
Right. I mean, I'm holding a piece of paper in my wallet right now. It says 100 bucks, 100 ringgit. Mm. But I can get 100 nice lima out there. But the value is derived from that paper, right? Mm. If you can do it, does it mean that it's not hard for the regular guy to actually understand it?
Exactly. I mean, ironically, I didn't have any interest at all in the economy or politics or anything prior to Bitcoin and blockchains. And I'll tell you why. It was because I had no hope. I'm a pessimist, and I see the worst in people and politics, and I've been seeing it my entire life, and I didn't know how I could contribute, help, or fix it. And it wasn't until blockchains came along that I realized there's now a technology that actually provides hope. Because these huge social problems are not just social problems, they're technological problems too. And we never had the technology to sort of force the transparency, to seek true governance in that sense. And now that with Bitcoin and blockchain technology, it gave me an interest in social politics and the economy. And I did a lot of learning. I did 2 years of trying to figure out how the world works from a monetary point of view.
For a pessimist, you do speak very rosy future right now. Have you changed your position?
Blockchain changed everything for me. It gave me hope. This technology that was created for the people, by the people, we just need to let the people know.
I'm speaking to Mark Smalley, the CTO of Neuroware. They are a blockchain technology company. Up next, we'll be talking more about the future of blockchain and how this will revolutionize how mankind lives. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this morning, I'm speaking to Mark Smalley, the Chief Technology Officer of Neuroware. Mark, we're still on the advent of the reshaping of the paradigm of how we do things, particularly how we can bridge technology with the financial situation, financial markets right now. There is not one day that passes that anyone is not going to talk about money. Poor is talking about money every day, so is the rich.
It's expensive to be poor.
Exactly. And this dominates the conversation every single day, every single moment of our lives. Does it mean that a conversation on blockchain will become as intertwined and as synonymous as the conversation with money in the future?
Digital currencies and blockchain are not necessarily the same thing, for sure. But going back to the cost of money, we spend $1 trillion annually at the moment just producing and moving cash around. The thought that we have these vans filled with paper and people driving them carrying guns in order to protect that cash seems really ludicrous to me when I'm living in a digital world where we're able to instantly transfer $1 million in value from one side of the planet to the other within seconds, have it instantly settled and cost only 4 cents.
From my conversation with my circle of friends, apparently China, for instance, is extremely advanced in terms of developing blockchain technology, not least on the cryptocurrency. Is this assessment true? In your opinion, China is advanced?
China is advanced in many ways, for sure. I mean, they have a very advanced cashless system. I don't know the numbers, but there was a really interesting study on how many transactions go over the WeChat sort of social networks and stuff. And it outweighs all the payment gateways globally combined. It's just an amazing amount of commerce going on in the cashless space. From a more regulatory perspective, Switzerland's made some interesting moves recently as well. They're starting to introduce a new banking license specifically for crypto. So it's a crypto banking license. They're probably one of the first countries to be discussing these kind of regulations at this level. Singapore is leading the way for sure here in Southeast Asia at the moment, especially with the FinTech Festival that took place last week and the headlines they've been making there. I can say that there's some similarly very interesting things happening in Malaysia, but the headlines are not quite there yet. Malaysia has an interesting, again, this is why I kind of like the way that the regulators have been working here. They have a very cautious approach. They're not in a rush to make headlines without substance.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing for a regulator, right?
Exactly. So yeah, I strongly believe that distributed ledgers are going to be a huge thing in Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia needs them more than the West, for sure. In the West, we have this sort of understanding, this rumored understanding that the regulators are no longer in control and that the nation's controlled by the corporations. In Southeast Asia, that's not the case. The regulators are still in control. And so from a global perspective, blockchains are going to be huge here in Southeast Asia. And because Malaysia has such a good, firm understanding of the English language, I think Malaysia is going to be at the center of that change.
So does this mean that countries like Hong Kong or Singapore would also have that kind of advantage because of the comprehension of English used in the markets?
No, less so, because they have their connections, existing connections with the Western world.
Less so?
Yes. I do believe Malaysia is going to be at the heart of this global phenomenon.
So this is a competitive advantage?
Yeah, for us, yes. Yeah. And we have a long-term mentality here in Malaysia. We don't rush into things. We take our time.
What about the scandals that have been dogging the country?
Exactly. Even more reason. Things have got to change, and now they will change. Yeah. They have to.
There is this problem that people don't understand what they're doing. I'm not just saying who in which organization or which political party or whatever. I'm just saying the level of comprehension that they are at is extremely different from what we need them to be in order to for this to work.
Which is why it's hard work. It's taken us 18 months of education and we're still halfway there, aren't we?
We're already blaming technologists for not communicating well. Do you think that the media is at fault as well for not understanding this better?
A fault, if fault is easy to pass around, yes.
Yes, okay. There's also this big news that came from SC that was, well, ill-recorded in the sense that this is the first time that the ECF or equity crowdfunding was able to accept Bitcoin from raising funds through these ECF platforms. Is that an accurate depiction?
That's interesting, yeah, because Malaysia is probably the first nation in the world to not only regulate equity crowdfunding, but allow for direct Bitcoin investments to be made into those companies raising funds on the platform too. From my understanding, this is a world first, which is important because if we look over the sort of the Guinness Book of Records for crowdfunding as a whole, you'll find that the top 10 out of 25 of the largest crowdfunding projects ever to raise are all Bitcoin related. And at the moment, there's about $1 billion going into unlicensed crowdfunding through Bitcoin. And yet Malaysia is sitting here with a licensed, fully regulated equity crowdfunding platform that also accepts Bitcoin. I think, you know...
The volume is nowhere near 1 billion then.
Exactly. No, it's just starting.
And with this in mind, do you think that Malaysia is heading in the right direction, even at this pace that we're talking of?
Oh, definitely. This is a suitable pace. I was expecting it to take even longer than this, to be honest. The fact that Singapore are making moves quickly certainly helps us keep things in perspective here, for sure. And I think...
You mean they're getting nervous because Singapore is faster?
Yes. But the interesting perspective here is I think the whole notion of regulation, especially within the fintech space, is going to radically change. I mean, traditionally, regulators have never participated in networks. They've only set standards or sort of pushed and prodded people. Again, because there wasn't a technology that allowed them to get actively involved. I think as blockchain technology becomes more prevalent throughout the ecosystem, I think the regulators are going to start realizing that they can take a very active approach.
To make things into reality, sometimes these big corporations come into play, and there's no other big operation in China other than Alibaba and through the platform Alipay. Do you think that these kind of corporations can hijack the whole thing and make it their own, and we're back to square one in terms of, you know, regulated cash?
Well, we certainly will if the regulators get lazy. Again, but that, I don't see that happening here in Malaysia, especially. They're taking a very active approach to the technology and how regulation as a whole might change over time.
How would you influence technology startups and technopreneurs and you know, and banks in Malaysia for that matter? How do you? What's your advice for them listening in trying to embrace this and be part of this revolution? They don't want to be bystanders, clearly.
Well, they should either get in touch with us for some professional training or have a look at our embassy website. So we recently launched something called the Blockchain Embassy of Asia, and it's Malaysia's first blockchain consortium. Has a few different partners involved. We have RHB Bank involved, Mark Wang Kwai Associates, a few others. The domain is bce.asia.
As of January 2016, more than 60 banks and leading financial institutions have made statements confirming that they are actively working on blockchain projects. Of the 60, none of them are Malaysian banks.
No.
Why is that?
Again, we have a mentality here to be more cautious and not necessarily chase headlines without substance. We do have some very interesting projects going on behind the scenes, and when they are announced, they will be of some substance.
I've been speaking to Mark Smalley, the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Neuroware Incorporated. Thanks for coming on the show. I am Ibrahim Sani for BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.